It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheim. In the wake of the deadly ISIS attacks in Belgium that left at least 31 people dead and 270 injured, counterterrorism experts around the world are looking at what's driving ISIS terrorism. Why was Brussels attacked? And are more attacks likely, including here in the United States? And what can be done to stop them? I'm joined now in studio by internationally recognized counterterrorism expert Colin Clark, associate political scientist at the Pittsburgh office of the RAND Corporation. Colin Clark, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation with your comments at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Colin Clark, what have you learned as a counterterrorism expert from the events yesterday in Belgium?
Yeah, so it confirms my belief that the threat is real, Europe is more vulnerable than the United States, both in terms of geography, I think, and demographics, from the threat of terrorism, specifically from ISIS. And I think that ISIS has clearly demonstrated both the will and the capability to conduct spectacular attacks, not only in the region in places like Iraq and Syria, but also across the globe, as evidenced by Paris last November and then Brussels just recently.
And you know, we're wondering what some of the latest information is. You have been monitoring this very closely and have been speaking on a number of outlets throughout the country and throughout the world, actually. What are you hearing up to the minute information?
So the chief bomb maker, Najim Lachoui, has been apprehended. And that two of the suspects that blew themselves up yesterday were brothers, Khalid and Ibrahim El-Barawi. Which is not altogether totally uncommon for brothers to be involved. Salah Abdeslam, who was apprehended about 4 days ago that started this whole series of events in motion, he was the brother of one of the attackers in the November Paris attacks who blew himself up. And so we've seen this before. We saw it with the Boston Marathon bombers. Those are Nave brothers. And we've seen it before with the attacks the previous January in Paris at the Charlie Hebdo offices with the Kouachi brothers.
So why do you suppose we're seeing this pattern of brothers being involved in these horrific attacks?
It gets to the heart of the matter on radicalization. And this is something that, you know, I think not only the United States, but the Europeans and Western nations worldwide have really struggled with, which is countering violent extremism. And we really just don't quite understand yet why people become radicalized. Oh, I shouldn't say that. They become radicalized for so many reasons, but we're often looking for the silver bullet to solve the issue. And sometimes it comes down not to a matter of ideology, but to kinship networks and friendship ties. Some people go because they're seeking adventure. So when you have six individuals, for example, from a neighborhood in Norway that go and join ISIS, there's no way that all six of these folks were radicalized to the point of believing in the ideology. It's likely that one or two did, and the others are just kind of along for the ride.
A definite link has been established between the Paris and Brussels attacks, that they came from the same cell. How could terrorists, under intense scrutiny, still pull off what they pulled off at seemingly obvious targets, the airport and a busy train station, places that have been targeted before?
Yeah, I think this speaks to the failure of the Belgian security services. They're notorious within Europe for shortcomings on counterterrorism. Compared to some other EU countries, Belgium spends very little on civilian and military intelligence and lacks serious overseas intelligence gathering capabilities. At the federal level, it has very weak law enforcement structures, highly decentralized. And so, you know, and I don't mean to pile on because a lot of counterterrorism analysts have been poking holes and pointing out just how weak the Belgian security services are. But, you know, that's what we're dealing with. It's a fact.
And one of the things that you mentioned before we started the show is that you have a number of agencies in Belgium that don't necessarily share information. And one of the problems results from the multilingual society there. You have a society where they're speaking French, Flemish, German. What kind of problems does that create?
Yeah, so Belgium's a country of six governments. Brussels, a city with 19 mayors. So there's a lack of a strong central authority. You've got some of the police services speaking German, some speaking Flemish, some speaking French, very few Arabic speakers. And so right there, you've got a cacophony of interests seemingly struggling to all achieve the same goal, but sometimes working at cross purposes.
What can you tell us about the neighborhood of Molenbeek? Are there problems that are emanating specifically from this one particular area? Apparently there are.
Yeah, so Molenbeek has been under intense scrutiny. It's actually been linked to numerous terrorist plots, all the way back to the Al-Qaeda assassins that killed Ahmed Shah Massoud in the prelude up to 9/11. One of the perpetrators of that attack had spent time in Molenbeek. Hassan El-Hosky, who was linked to the 2004 Madrid bombings that killed 192 people, lived there briefly. The attack on the Brussels Jewish Museum, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and then the failed train attack in Amsterdam, all linked back to Molenbeek. You're talking about a place where there's 30% unemployment. That number's probably higher if you look at the younger demographics. It's 80% Moroccan origin originally. And this is an area where alcohol sales have been banned. There are Salafist preachers walking through the streets. And so it's a fairly insular neighborhood within a very liberal European country.
Are there other Molenbeeks in Europe?
I mean, we'd be naive not to think so. I think there's certainly other Molenbeeks out there, whether these are in the Netherlands, Italy, Germany. Clearly, France has a major issue. There's upwards of 1,200 French that have gone to fight in Iraq and Syria. So this issue isn't unique to Belgium, and it's widespread across Europe in general.
And I know you don't want to get into, as you call it, piling on here, because there has been some criticism of the Belgian authorities. But one would have to think that the authorities in Belgium had to know that this was coming. Why weren't they ready for it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think they are obviously doing their best. One of the things when we talk about terrorism and terrorism networks is think about it in terms of concentric circles. So there's the smallest circle, which is your hardcore, your battle-hardened militants, right, with battlefield experience. Beyond that, you've got what we talk about as active supporters. These are individuals that will be document forgers or supply weapons. And then an even larger concentric circle beyond that are what are known as passive supporters, which clearly there are a lot of in Molenbeek. So these are people that may provide a safe house, or being a passive supporter may be as simple as just not dropping a dime on someone when you know there's a suspected terrorist living in the flat across the hall, because either you share that ideology or you're so distrustful of the security services. Now, on the security services front, clearly there are too many suspects for them to track, monitor, and surveil. I think it comes down to a matter of resources. There's so many suspects, and the authorities just don't have the manpower to cover them all.
Why would someone be suspicious of the security services?
Yeah, I mean, there could be perceived discrimination. Again, these are people that are largely living in a very insular neighborhood within, what is a fairly liberal European country. They may not speak the same language. They may not have the same customs. Clearly, they're a lot more conservative religiously in some areas. And I think, look, we have it here in the United States. There's a distrust with certain communities of the police, of law enforcement. And I don't think, you know, that's not unique to the United States. It's not unique to Belgium, but it does present a problem.
Is part of the fear that if I give information to the authorities, drop a dime, as you put it, that there's no assurance that I'm going to be protected?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, some of it's out of fear. Some of it is because, you know, if I do say something, then, you know, there's going to be retribution against me. But certainly some of it is out of a sense of solidarity, that there is a shared ideology, with that Salafist jihadist kind of network.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is internationally recognized counterterrorism expert Colin Clark. He is an associate political scientist at the Pittsburgh office of the RAND Corporation. If you'd like to join the conversation with a comment or question, the number is 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. I had among my list of questions about whether the attacks are the result of last week's arrest of Salah Abdeslam, a suspect in the Paris bombings, who again was picked up Thursday of last week. And you have already indicated that that seems to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, at least according to ISIS, if we take them at their word. And also just the quick turnaround from the time that he was apprehended to the time that these attacks took place, it seems likely that there were sleeper cells in place with the directive to, if he was captured, go forth with this attack. Furthermore, just chew on these numbers for a bit. 562 Belgians have fought in Iraq and Syria so far. 124 from Brussels alone. This is a country with a population of 11 million people. So that's the most per capita foreign fighters fighting in Iraq and Syria. 75 are known to have returned. So that's what the security services know about. So again, pretty high numbers when we're talking about known terrorist foreign fighters coming back to live in and around Belgium.
So when they return, what happens? Are they, I would assume they're being tracked?
Again, to the extent that there are resources available, you know, we learned from the Charlie Hebdo attacks that the Kouachi brothers had come across the radar of law enforcement, but then after a while dropped back off because other people were deemed a higher priority. And so, again, when you have the sheer numbers, I think it's a matter of resources. It's a matter of monitoring, tracking, surveilling. But yeah, I mean, it's a huge problem.
And it's a problem that affects everybody in the world. So what does the rest of the world need to do to bolster the security forces in these areas, which are, you know, a hotbed, you know, the Molenbeek neighborhoods of the world that are producing this kind of terrorist activity? We're hearing that the United States is providing help from the FBI.
Right.
Some might wonder, well, why wasn't that done sooner?
Sure. Well, you know, the country's got to be willing to invite others in. And I think, you know, just as it's difficult within Belgium proper for the security services to coordinate, it's also difficult for the Belgians to coordinate with the Dutch, the Brits, the French, the Germans, so on and so forth. I imagine there may be some cold warriors in the group that are still very protective, right, and still think in terms of nation states. But in this era of globalization, we've got to think beyond just the nation state. To non-state actors, right? These jihadists don't recognize any borders. But if the intelligence sharing stops at the border, that's highly problematic. These guys look at the border between Iraq and Syria much in the same way they look at the border between France and Belgium, and that's to say non-existent.
And so when it comes to the question of could authorities have stopped the Brussels attacks, there is not as an answer that is as seemingly simple as there could be, that it's a lot more nuanced, that there are a lot more extenuating circumstances involved here.
Yeah, I think there's extenuating circumstances. I think certainly they could have stopped the attack, but, you know, given greater intelligence sharing, greater collaboration between law enforcement and intelligence. And I think that, you know, one of the things we need to think about is it's really not about preventing all attacks. That's just not feasible. It's really not possible. It's about mitigating the threat. And there are other ways that we can go about mitigating the threat.
And what would they be? What do you think?
Starting at the political level, one way is avoiding inflammatory rhetoric. And we're seeing the rise of the right wing in European countries coming out calling for you know, certain restrictions to be placed on Muslims in particular. Well, by doing that, you're alienating the very communities that you need intelligence from the most, and it's just really not smart. It doesn't make sense from a policy perspective.
What about here in the United States? We are, I don't think I need to remind anybody that we're in the middle of a presidential race. Today, Ted Cruz was making the rounds on at least a couple of national morning news shows, and said that the police should patrol Muslim neighborhoods here in the United States. Donald Trump has said things like we need to bring back waterboarding. What do you think about these ideas, and how do they impact the problem of dealing with terrorism, with attacks by ISIS and other extremist groups?
Sure. And I'm not here to make any partisan statements. In fact, most of my comments are based on empirical evidence and research. But taking the comments at face value from a policy perspective, I think they're antithetical to what we should be doing. I think they're foolish, that they're unrealistic. I think that threatening to torture people really doesn't make much sense. And to going in and policing Muslim neighborhoods, it just shows, kind of an ignorance of the situation in the United States, just how different it is from those of Europe, because they're completely different situations.
Our guest, Colin Clark, with the RAND Corporation, a political scientist and internationally recognized counterterrorism expert, with us here in studio. And you can reach us with a comment or question at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Let's go to Zach in Pittsburgh. Hi, Zach. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The Pittsburgh Symphony has a European tour scheduled for May and June, about 3 weeks long. We'll be playing in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and Belgium. And I'm just wondering if there's an opinion as to whether that seems like a good idea for a fairly high-profile organization from the United States, or whether there is cause to be concerned about that.
And Zach, before you hang up there, if you're still on the line, are you associated with the symphony at all?
I'm a member of the symphony. And I do know a few months ago the Dallas Symphony canceled their scheduled European tour out of security concerns. That was a few months ago. So I'm not being alarmist. I'm just curious as to your opinion as to whether or not that seems like a good idea.
Well, it's certainly a legitimate question, and the guy who has the opinion you want to hear from is Colin Clark.
Yeah, I mean, Zach, I wouldn't be too worried about it. I don't think that the symphony presents any extraordinary specific target. People ask me all the time, should I be scared to go here, there? I mean, frankly, I'm more worried of getting shot at the movie theater than I am of dying at the hands of a terrorist, just looking at the sheer numbers, at least in this country. But no, I wouldn't be worried about that unless there's specific information indicating that organization has been targeted, and I haven't heard anything to anticipate that it would be.
But what about just as an American? We tend to like to wear things that say USA on them. Do Americans need to move about with a lower profile nowadays?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's always smart to have your head on a swivel, to be aware of your surroundings, to be cautious. But, I think that's always good advice, not just right after a terrorist attack. Certainly 9/11 has heightened Americans' awareness of the threat of international terrorism. But no, I wouldn't be overly concerned.
You were just in Europe. You just got back a few days ago?
I did. Yep, I got back Saturday evening.
So what about, you were speaking in Germany. Talk about your experience there. What were you seeing as you moved about? What kind of hurdles did you have to go through at the airport, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I gave a talk at the Marshall Center down in Garmisch in southern Germany in the Bavarian Alps. I was giving a talk on terrorism. And on the way back, I flew through Munich. And I'm usually quite particular about getting to the airport early for international flights. So I think I was there about 2.5 hours early, thinking I'll get through customs. I'll pick up a gift for my wife. I'll get something to eat and, maybe grab the newspaper. Well, I barely made my flight 2.5 hours in. I think I was screened 4 separate times. And I started thinking to myself, this is kind of, this is odd. This isn't usual. I hadn't heard any rumblings of a threat to Germany or Munich. So who knows? Maybe the security services were on high alert.
Probably after the arrest.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And so there was extra scrutiny. I guess in a sense it makes you feel safer. But also, my wife lost out on some German chocolate. So it's all a trade-off.
When you say you were screened 4 different times, okay, so you're screened when you're going to the gate. How and where else would you be screened?
Yeah, there was just multiple hurdles to get through. There was so many different lines. I must have gone through at least 4 different places where my bag was screened, where I was asked what I was doing in Germany, where my bag was opened, and lo and behold, I have all these books on terrorism, right? Which would be a pretty bad cover. Uh, but But yeah, and so just confirming, and one of the screeners, the first woman that screened me was also the fourth. And I said, oh, well, you remember me. I just saw you. And it was stone cold face. No, I'm going to screen you like I've never seen you before.
Were these at points where you would expect to be screened? Like, you know, here in the United States, at an airport, you come up, you see the things that you have to walk through and the wands and the whole, right. you see it coming. And it's like, here we go. Was this people popping out at random or?
No, there was just almost the way I would describe it as checkpoints along the way. Huh. So figuring once I got through the first time, my bags
you were good
checked,
to go.
Screened, right? I don't have anything on me. But then it was multiple screenings after that. It was just, you know, I just noticed it because I think about these things constantly. And the fact that it took almost 2.5 hours, I mean, I barely made my flight.
Based on what we saw yesterday at the airport in Brussels, we saw terrorists in the airport. Now they hadn't gotten to the areas where you are screened, obviously, but there they were in the airport. They have in the United States and elsewhere they've stopped letting you go to the gate at the airport without being screened. Have we gotten to the point where we now need to stop allowing people to even go into the airport without being screened?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something to think about. We often talk in terms of hard versus soft targets. And traditionally, I would consider the airport a very hard target. But on the perimeter, there's definitely elements of it being a soft target because you can get a certain way into the building without having a ticket, right? I mean, if you're meeting somebody, if you're dropping somebody off. And we saw, I think, a couple of years ago in the States, a TSA agent was shot in Los Angeles. We've seen terrorism in Russia where terrorists have targeted airports up until that more hardened security barrier. So, you know, you never know. It's something that we could very well see. I'm not a transportation security expert by any stretch, but I do think a lot about the different ways that terrorists attack and transportation in general, the metro, the subway. These are traditionally very soft targets. From a terrorist perspective, big return on investment, right? Very high profile, likely to kill a lot of people, and the psychological damage is worth much more than the actual casualties.
Which brings us back to the question of, okay, if this wasn't an intelligence failure per se, and we've certainly seen a problem, as you mentioned, with agencies talking to one another. We've seen that here in the United States, and that's something we might want to get into as we progress in this conversation. But was because of the targets that you mentioned, that the places where you would expect terrorists to strike, was it a security failure?
You know, I don't really differentiate between an intelligence and a security failure. I look at that as synonymous. I mean, I think we've got to have agencies that work hand in glove. Now, we don't. But if we consider the nature of the threat, I mean, these terrorist networks stretch from the banlieues of Paris all the way to the streets of Raqqa and Mosul, right? And again, our enemies aren't, they're not thinking in terms of stovepipes and agencies and borders, and I don't think we should either. And so I think we should look at this more comprehensively. There's certainly got to be a more integrated approach to the way that we consider security.
And as you mentioned that, one of the problems that was identified as with the 9/11 attacks here in the U.S., that agencies weren't talking to each other. And we're talking about the FBI and the CIA had gathered intelligence. And we're not sharing it. They weren't talking about what they had. They weren't saying, hey, we're looking into this. Why don't you look into that? Have we solved that problem?
I think in the U.S. it's gotten much better. But, you know, and there are people far smarter than myself that have documented this. People like Lawrence Wright in his book, The Looming Tower, Steve Call in his great book, Ghost Wars, that have talked about those kind of interagency rivalries and any kind of buzzword bureaucratic term you want to throw out there, protective of rice bowls, aware of stovepipes, all these, you know, firewalls, all these things that exist. And at the end of the day, humans have egos, right? And so maybe they're a little bit less prone to sharing information because they want to make the big break. They want to be the ones that get all the glory, even though, you know, this is very much about public service and protecting the public. But, you know, these are real issues I think we're grappling with. But I do think, I will say, I think there's been tremendous progress, at least in the United States, since 9/11.
Everything you say makes sense, and yet it's shocking to hear that these kinds of rivalries, really what amount to petty rivalries in the grand scheme of things. We're talking with Colin Clark. He's associate political scientist at the Pittsburgh office of the RAND Corporation. He's with us until the end of the show, and you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002 with a comment or a question. If security were expanded at airports, is that something that you would be okay with, or do you find that there's already enough inconvenience that you are not willing to put up with increased security? One of the things that certainly is going to be talked about and is being talked about in the wake of the attacks in Brussels yesterday. Again, our number 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. We'll continue our conversation with Colin Clark here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with Colin Clark, a internationally recognized counterterrorism expert with the Pittsburgh office of the RAND Corporation. And in the wake of the attacks yesterday in Belgium, this is certainly a topic of conversation that is foremost in the minds of people all over the world, and certainly those of us here in Pittsburgh. You can join the conversation with your comments or questions at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Colin Clark, a link, as we have mentioned, has been established between the Paris and Brussels attacks, and we hear that it's the same cell. We're also now hearing that it's more of a network than a terrorist cell per se. Can you explain this?
Yeah, so it's a network in the sense that it's horizontal. Rather than the old kind of top-down vertical command and control type structures that we're used to, it operates across the globe. So if we think of its center in a place like Raqqa, Syria, or Mosul, Iraq, and then think of ISIS as what they call wilayats, otherwise known as regional affiliates, and these are in places like the Sinai in Egypt, in Libya, in South Asia, in the North Caucasus on the Russian border. And then clearly there's operatives that have been spread throughout the globe, particularly in places like Europe, where there seems to be fertile ground for recruitment and radicalization. And then there's the internet, which this group uses to inspire individuals, homegrown radicals all across the world, including here in the United States.
Right. And as I heard someone say, you can increase security, you can build a wall, you can do all these things, but you can't stop the reach of the internet.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the internet is pervasive. It's especially when you consider the use of cell phones and internet capabilities on cell phones. It's really, really difficult to counter violent extremism on the web.
What is driving the sophisticated reach of ISIS terrorism?
So I'd actually argue that it's not that sophisticated. I'd say
really?
That if you think about it, it costs less than $10,000 in a lot of these cases to conduct an attack, especially the ones in Europe, where you think about what you need. You need weapons, you need logistics, so things like a car, a safe house, maybe a forged passport, cell phones, and a safe house. And really, the hardest part is what we call OPSEC, or operational security, having the people that are a part of the plot not spilling the beans, not bragging about this on social media, or not being apprehended before the plot is set in motion by the authorities.
How did you arrive at the figure of $10,000?
There's been a study by some researchers in Scandinavia where they looked at all of the attacks and all the public source information available, and the number was over three quarters of the attacks in Europe conducted specifically by jihadist terrorists have cost less than $10,000.
That's driving people in the Office of Homeland Security crazy when they hear that.
Well, yeah, and last summer I published a book on called Terrorism Inc. on the financing of terrorism, insurgency, and irregular warfare. And so there are various ways that terrorists can conduct can raise money, and things as simple as fraud, right? So defaulting on a credit card or mortgage fraud or all these other ways, stealing iPhones. I mean, really simple ways, kind of petty crime and burglaries that we often don't think of. I was doing an interview with Forbes magazine a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about this phenomenon of European jihadis relying on fraud to fund their terror attacks and to get them to the battlefield in Iraq and Syria. And I kind of said it tongue in cheek, but it stuck with the reporter where I said, look, if your plan is to kill yourself and commit martyrdom, you're not really concerned about your credit score.
That actually makes a lot of sense. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Bob in Pittsburgh with a question. Hi, Bob, or a comment, actually. Hi, Bob.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask, with the security tightening in the airports, wouldn't that just move the soft target part of the airport to the outside onto the sidewalk? I would think that preventing people from coming inside without tickets would just shift where the soft part of the target would be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a way that's true. The goal is ultimately to deter an attack on the institution or the building altogether by making the target so hard that there's really no point in attacking someone on the sidewalk. At that point, one would think you'd devote your resources to attacking somewhere else where you're likely to kill more people if that's your ultimate goal and to raise the profile of the attack.
Thank you, Bob. Let's go to Jim in Pleasant Hills with a question. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. I want to know, the ISIS goal is to kill everybody who is not them or to convert other Muslims. What is the bottom line? What is their goal across the world?
What is their ultimate goal?
Yeah, so I'd say the ultimate goal is to build an Islamic caliphate in Iraq and Syria. And anything that stands in the way of that goal, they're likely to strike out against. So I think what we're seeing now is a manifestation of the United States and its coalition partners attempting to prevent ISIS from reaching that goal of building the caliphate. So we're conducting airstrikes. We're taking ISIS territory away. We're choking off its finances. And this is a way for the group to strike out. Look, and if you listen to or if you read some of the public statements that some of the terrorists have made, they're very aware of foreign policies of nations. They think that if they hit Belgium or France hard enough, this is going to cause those governments to withdraw their troops from abroad and to stop the strikes on Iraq and Syria, which is the ultimate goal. If you think back to 2004 with the Madrid attacks, Al-Qaeda blew up a commuter train in Madrid right before the Spanish elections with the ultimate goal of changing the outcome of the elections to a party that was likely to withdraw Spanish troops. That's exactly what happened. So when people ask, does terrorism work, I would point to that example and say, look, here's a clear example where terrorists got exactly what they wanted by killing large amounts of people. And I don't think that's a precedent that we want to set.
I heard a commentator say yesterday that ISIS is doing things that Al-Qaeda could only dream of. What do you make of that? And what is it that is, if it is in fact true that ISIS has found some either sophisticated or unsophisticated way of surpassing Al-Qaeda, how have they done that?
Yeah, so to me, the key is holding territory. Al-Qaeda was never able to hold large swaths of territory like ISIS is currently doing. And so because Al-Qaeda, you know, very shortly after 9/11 was constantly on the run. They were pushed out of Afghanistan, across the border into the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, into North and South Waziristan, and were living under the constant threat of drone strikes. They were never able to hold large amounts of territory. ISIS has been able to accomplish that for a couple of reasons. One, they've taken advantage of the security vacuum as a result of the Syrian civil war. And two, on the other side of the border in Iraq, they've galvanized Sunni Iraqi Arabs that have been marginalized by the Shia regime in Baghdad. And so they've carved out this large swath of territory that straddles both sides of the border. They've built an infrastructure. And look, they've been successful in battle, too. Let's not ignore that. And that, in turn, has helped them garner more recruits, particularly from abroad.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Colin Clark with a comment or question. 412-246-2002. One of the things about ISIS, you know, you talked about, you know, the whole aspect of martyrdom that exists with this, and of course it did with Al-Qaeda as well. Is there, as a counterterrorism expert, is there any way that you've tried to understand this idea that there's you can't go too low in the minds of these people. I mean, clearly when you are setting bombs off in a place where women are and men are walking through with their children and babies in strollers, you clearly have no kind of hesitation on any kind of moral level. How do they get to that point? What allows them to justify in their minds that this is okay to do?
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, if you look no further than the kind of very heinous, very grotesque practices of sexual slavery that the group has enacted, where it's taken Yazidi women and made them sex slaves, Al-Qaeda wouldn't even go that far, right? And so that's certainly beyond the pale with anything we've seen in the recent annals of modern terrorism. And I could only struggle to begin to explain what the mindset is of somebody that does that, other than to call them, you know, a sociopath. But that's not our goal here, is to denigrate these people. We are trying to understand them. It's very, very difficult, Paul.
Let's go to Carr in Pittsburgh with a question. Hi, welcome.
So one of the questions that I had was, you know, we...
Carr, are you still there? We do have his question on the screen, and this is something that has come up with people. It seems that there's more media coverage when terrorist attacks take place in Western Europe.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I would definitely agree with that. You know, it's something I discuss with my students at Carnegie Mellon University. Every class we open up by spending 5 or 10 minutes talking about current events. There can be a terrorist attack in Europe where 2 or 3 people are killed and it's major news coverage for a week. Then you think about what's happening with Boko Haram in Nigeria.
Sure.
150 people will be killed in the course of a week, and it's, you know, you can barely find it on page 8 of the New York Times. So I'm not exactly sure what's driving that you know, disparity in coverage, but it certainly seems to be true from my own observation.
ISIS is threatening more attacks. Where is it likely to strike next?
Very, very difficult to say, obviously. I mean, there are the most likely candidates, places where they maintain a very robust presence. So obviously Iraq and Syria, then closer at home in the region, places like Turkey, where we've seen them strike already, Tunisia, clearly Libya, which has become, a kind of failed state right on the Mediterranean. But I would point to perhaps those countries in Europe where the most foreign fighters have left abroad to go fight in Iraq and Syria and have potentially returned home. And I think the top four here are France, the United Kingdom, Germany, and Belgium, of course.
There is a concern, of course, about an attack on American soil, that, you know, these super radicalized individuals or small groups could carry out an attack on American soil. What are the chances of this?
Yeah, I mean, I always hesitate to put a number or quantify or put a percentage on this because that just doesn't make any sense. But as we've seen with San Bernardino, the odds aren't zero, right? And so very difficult, although I will say, we clearly don't have the same issues that Europe has. And I mentioned in the opening, both in terms of geography and demographics. And what I meant by that was we're surrounded by two oceans, so we're not connected to the landmass the same way that Europe is with the Middle East. And then in terms of demographics, we don't have the same sense of aggrieved minority Muslim population in the United States, socioeconomically or otherwise, that feel that they're not actually American, that they're caught in this netherworld and more vulnerable to radicalization, as we've seen in pretty large neighborhoods and parts of Europe.
Let's go to caller at 412-246-2002. We have Linda in Pittsburgh. Hi, Linda. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I wonder if you could just perhaps touch on and talk a little bit about the differences between the radicals and the standard believers of Islam and Muslims, and maybe what the percentage difference is, because I'm very concerned about the victimization and misunderstanding of, you know, the differences in victimization of the innocent people that are being branded, you know, because of the talk. It does worry me that when we're covering these subjects, no one ever seems to underscore, or it's rarely underscored, that there are so many innocent people in that face that don't have these beliefs.
That's a great point, Linda, and it may take more than the minute or less, actually, that we have left in the show for Colin to answer it, but do your best in about 45 seconds or so.
So there are 1 billion Muslims worldwide, and I think the vast overwhelming majority have nothing to do with extreme Salafist, Wahhabist, radical jihadi interpretation of Islam. And I agree with the caller. I think it's a shame that when people paint broadly with the same brush, but that's why the onus is on us as Americans to go further and look at the complexities and the nuances and study this and figure it out, and so we can educate ourselves to realize that no, that's not the case.
Thank you very much for that call, Linda, and I'm afraid we've just about come to time for this program, but I want to thank our guest, Colin Clark, who's been a wealth of information on this topic. He is an internationally recognized counterterrorism expert. He's been a very busy man in the last 24 hours or so. He's an associate political scientist at the Pittsburgh office of the RAND Corporation, a professor at CMU, also teaches at the University of Pittsburgh, and his book is Terrorism, Inc., which you can pick up, I'm sure, at a variety of locations. Colin Clark, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a very fascinating visit, and you've been a wealth of information on this topic.
Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.